Hey everyone, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and this is a place where I bring you authentic conversations with people who are willing to share their journey through seasons of grief. No matter your cultural upbringing, societal conditioning, or faith practice, grief affects us all. Whether you're dealing with a loss, a diagnosis, a broken heart, or the everyday stressors of life, or love someone who is, these conversations are here to support you in that process. So be sure to check out the show notes for potential trigger warnings. And whether you're very comfortable with or deeply avoidant of grief and its many responses, you are welcome here. Thank you for being here, and now on to the episode. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and I have with me today, this is a resume. I have Dave Boyd, who is a Marine vet, former SWAT officer, former 911 operator, school resource officer, community policing officer, former firefighter, turned trauma-informed men's coach, and president of the Uncivilized Incorporated Work. Wow. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to come talk about grief, talk about public safety, talk about veterans work, all those kinds of things. Talk about men's work a little bit. I hope so too. Very grateful to have the opportunity to be here with you today.
I'm grateful to have you. And the whole entire reason I wanted to have you on because of that resume, and to understand the experiences you've had have likely brought you to grief, and not just the grief of the work as a first responder, but also the grief of your decision to move away from that work into the men's work that you do now. And we'll get to that. And to begin, though, I would love to know your cultural upbringing and background.
Yeah, so I was born in Texas. I had a rough first couple of years of my life between my parents. My parents separated when I was, I think, about 18 months. And my mom moved me across the country to move back with my grandparents for a few years. Grew up in a lower middle class family. Grew up in a trailer park outside of Detroit, essentially, is the best way to put it. Moved to North Carolina just before high school to kind of an affluent suburb of Raleigh, North Carolina. And then I was there pretty much until I joined the Marine Corps, and then unfortunately had the bad luck, I think is the best way to put it, to get stationed 2 hours away from home when I joined to see the world, but gave me the opportunity to meet my wife. So I can't complain too much.
Oh, that's great.
Because she was back home, and so I got to go home all the time. And so I got to get introduced to her through my mom. And so I'm still grateful for the opportunity to have been stationed there, even though it was miserable a lot of the time.
Okay, but it's North Carolina. I mean, that's one of my favorite states.
I do love North Carolina. I don't live there anymore. I'm now outside of Denver, Colorado. I moved out here kind of a lifelong dream a couple of years ago to access the outdoors, mountain biking, snowboarding, hiking, all those kinds of things, and to help grow the business that I help run with Mr. Traver Bohm, who was a recent guest on here as well.
Yes. Love the work of the Uncivilized Nation. So you just hit on another for the second question. Do you know your Enneagram number, which is very self-evident to me, but for our listeners?
Yes, I am an eight.
Stalker.
Yes. And everybody who knows me and knows about Enneagram is like, oh, that's no surprise.
No, because your resume reads like a human's guide to intense employment, but so do the things you love: mountain biking, skiing, moving to Colorado for all the outdoors, and the career choices just line up with intensity.
Yeah, I've always kind of had this saying. It drives my wife nuts, but it's I have no interest in doing something if it doesn't have a risk of serious physical injury or death.
Sure.
So but that kind of goes along with being an eight.
Yeah. And you found your niche over and over and over again for getting that level of risk.
Yes.
So what brought you to the actual thread of jobs and thread of career through first responder work?
Yeah. So my biological father was an airport firefighter in the Air Force. And I was always kind of interested in following in that path, but I wanted to do it better. And so instead of joining the Air Force, I joined the Marines.
Oh, wow. Fighting words. Okay. All right. My brother who's Air Force. He's, yeah. Okay. Fine.
So, you know, I did that, but I always had that, like, I really want to get in the fight, you know, like I joined the military to get in the fight, to go protect our country, you know, insert stereotypical 18-year-old high adrenaline, high testosterone young man. Mm-hmm. So I went overseas and I served in Afghanistan for 7 months running a personal security detail. And So that was kind of a different side of, you know, service, different kind of side of public safety that's not often talked about, those kinds of things. And I really enjoyed that while I was over there. But I had intended to be a career Marine. Like, I never had any intention to get out, become a cop, any of those kinds of things. But when I got home from Afghanistan, I got hurt in a training accident and had to have a couple of knee surgeries. Mm-hmm. And my body just wasn't healing from all the stress that I was under. You know, I came home, had a pretty nasty divorce from my ex-wife, got hurt, all those things. And because of all the stress, I also had undiagnosed PTSD at that time. And, you know, I just wasn't getting better. My body was yelling at me at the top of its lungs every day, like, this is not working and do something different. And so I got out and came home back to the Raleigh, North Carolina area. My now wife and I moved in together, and my goal was to get back into the fire service after I got better. And but I applied for a bunch of positions at local departments, and you know, you being a Southerner, you could probably relate to the good old boy system being very well and present in a lot of local government. And so I would make it all the way to the end, and then they would hire a volunteer and, you know, those kinds of things, or some, you know, the chief's nephew or whatever. And that's fine. But it, you know, it pushed me in the direction I needed to be in life. And so I decided I was going to go into 911 as kind of my in. I was like, oh man, like, if I can get into 911, like, that gets me connected into the local public safety community. And then hopefully I can try again for Raleigh Fire. And working as a telecommunicator for a couple of years, and, you know, taking all kinds of calls from, you know, suicidal subjects to giving CPR instructions to, you know, the stupid stuff. Like, we had a guy call during a snowstorm and, like, can we get the police to deliver pizza? You know, it's like, it runs, runs the gamut of absurd, completely absurd to completely traumatic. And I was really struggling, like, cause you obviously take a lot more police phone calls than you do, you know, fire. And through all that time connecting with the officers, wanting to be able to help the people calling in for help in a more physical way than just, you know, taking your information and hitting a button and sending a police officer your way, I decided instead of going back into the fire service that I was going to give this law enforcement thing a go for a while. And it was a great decision. I learned so much during my career in law enforcement. I'm very grateful for having had the opportunity to wear a badge and protect and serve honorably for, you know, over a decade in a couple of different agencies.
Yeah. Wow. So in that process, you've got a good bit of that, an undiagnosed PTSD?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And then these high intensity jobs. And from what I've seen is that the best way to do a job like what you've had, all of them, is the ability to compartmentalize. And so I've also seen that it seems that a lot of these jobs don't have a great support system for helping learn how to, yes, compartmentalize, but also how do you navigate those adrenal dumps of cortisol and adrenaline and go back into your everyday life? Like, what was your experience with that through those jobs?
So I'll say at 911, it was really difficult on the day-to-day life of it. You know, like, our schedule was it was awful for 3 weeks out of the month, and then you got an entire week off. So like we would work like Monday, Tuesday, day shift, be off Wednesday, come back in Thursday, Friday, work night shift, be off a couple days, switch back to day shift. And it was awful. You know, not just the adrenaline of all of that, you know, the cortisol and the insert neurotransmitter here, like there was also the sleep deprivation and the lack of sunlight and lack of movement during the day, because you're literally tethered to a desk with your headset for 12 plus hours a day. And so it was kind of like you just white knuckle it for 3 weeks and then rest and recuperate as best as you possibly can and take care of yourself as best you can during the week off. They're doing a better job at my old agency about all that now. They've changed the schedule a lot. They do a lot more for mental health, all those kinds of things. I was really lucky, I'll say this, in my law enforcement career, that mental health was something that they started talking about in my police academy. None of us paid attention, but at least they were talking, right? Like we're like day four in the academy, and we were really lucky to have a full-time police psychologist that we could go see and talk to 24 hours a day if we needed to. So she came in and talked to us, but we're all still like sitting at attention, like scared to death that we're going to fall asleep during class and get smoked, in PT afterwards. As part of their like mental health talk, they brought in an officer who had been on the job for a long time. He was big into Brazilian jiu-jitsu and mindfulness, meditation, all that kind of stuff. And we're 4 days in to the academy, and he's like, I'm going to teach you guys how to meditate today. And I'm like, what the hell does this have anything to do with being a police officer? And so we're all like, he's sitting up there, like takes his tie off, unbuttoning his top button, like is talking about like feeling your body and settling in and breathing. And all of us are just like, you know, conditioned black already. Like, I can't accept anything you have to tell me right now. But I was really lucky to have those conversations like introduced at the beginning of my career, have access to mental health resources. You know, I took advantage of it here and there. I know a lot of guys didn't, but I was really, you know, really grateful to have had that opportunity. Like I still have my police psychologist cell phone number saved in my phone. Like I, you know, I'll text her every once in a while and check in, those kinds of things. But you know, neither the military or public safety ever really, there's nothing that you can do to adequately prepare anyone to put on the uniform or put on the headset. Right. Whether that's talking about trauma or that's talking about grief or it's talking about self-care, like you can teach everybody all you want in the academy or an in-service training or insert moment here, roll call training, whatever, like, but until you experience it, you can't know what it does to your body. And unless you have the knowledge of what's happening inside your body, it's really difficult to like recognize it and say, oh crap, like I need to go take a few minutes for myself, or maybe I need to do some push-ups to reduce my cortisol levels or something like that in between calls. It's such a hard space to be in. And I think agencies across the country and the military are getting a lot better about it, but there's still work to be done, and which is why it's important that we have these conversations like we are today.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that process, the last job you had before you transitioned to what you're doing now, what was that, the police officer?
So I was a police officer, and then I left. So I was kind of building Uncivilized with Traver while I was a police officer and a CrossFit coach, and a husband and father. And then I left law enforcement to go work for a veterans nonprofit for a few years. A very large veterans nonprofit where I got the opportunity to learn a lot more about mental health. I got to learn a lot more about self-care. They were really great about us taking good care of ourselves, and training us and teaching us. We had a lot of veterans on staff, and connecting us with resources that would help. And I had the opportunity to go through some post-traumatic growth retreats and those kinds of things that really helped set me up in a successful way after leaving law enforcement. And then after that nonprofit stuff, I transitioned full-time to Uncivilized last year.
Okay. So was there a point in your career, all of it, that you had an experience that made you go, okay, wait, I might need more support than what I currently have?
Unfortunately, it was a fairly regular occurrence for me. I worked in statistically a couple of the roughest beats in the state of North Carolina. Lots of gang violence, lots of drugs, lots of, you know, lots of fights, lots of stabbings, shootings, rapes, robberies, murders, you name it, like insert bad thing here. And it was happening on a daily or weekly, if not daily basis, when I worked in those areas. And unfortunately, kind of like we talked about with 911 in those 3 weeks, it's the same thing in law enforcement. In my opinion, it's, you know, you're working a 12-hour shift, you get off work, you go home, you have a beer or two, maybe you connect with your significant other if you have the emotional capacity to, you pass out, you do it again. There isn't really enough space in between shifts to be able to get that good support to process, to allow your body to get off the hypervigilance roller coaster for a few hours and allow all of those chemicals that you've dumped into your body through all of these high adrenaline activities, not to mention the nicotine or the caffeine that helps you get through a shift. And then you're always on alert. There is no off duty truly for a police officer. You know, you go out, you still have your gun on, you still watchful, you're still paranoid. All of those things take place, even if you're not wearing your uniform and technically on duty. So there just wasn't enough space for the processing that needed to unfold, unfortunately.
Yeah. And you share, or I heard from Dr. Jeremy Goldberg, his podcast you were on, and you were sharing about this story. It had just aired about you. You had an experience as an officer, and I want to highlight this because it speaks to the character of who you are, that you had an experience as an officer that involved going viral. Can you tell me about that or tell us about that?
Which one? I actually had a couple of incidents.
Oh,
like that.
My bad.
So there was a sliding incident and a snowball fight, but then there was also one that was a tad bit more traumatic, which I think is probably what you're referencing.
That one.
So I was on duty, pretty rough, really rough neighborhood. I drove by somebody I thought had warrants, and so I stopped to look, you know, in my computer, pull up their name. And as I'm sitting there parked towards the road, I'm looking across at the other side of the apartment complex, and I see a fight break out. Between a man and a woman, and another woman was trying to break the two up. And so I hit the lights, pop the siren on, drive across the median, across the grass, into the parking lot, and jump out, you know, like, police stop, you know, the typical thing. That gave, you know, that distracted the guy who was attacking the woman, a moment of distraction, where he looked at me and the two women were able to run away. And then he focused his attention on me. And so I'm like, at this point, like I was an MMA fighter. I was like, okay, let's do this. You know, if you want to go, I'm not afraid to throw down with you, man. And he comes at me and takes a swing over my head, and I put my hand up and his hand glances off the top of my head. And I felt like something wet. When that happened, I didn't know what it was at that moment, but I felt something wet. And so I pushed him back. After he tried to swing at my head, pulled out my baton. I took a couple swings at his legs, and like, for those of you who can't see me watching, you know, if you're not watching on the YouTube channel, like, I'm a large human being, like, and I'm not saying that to be, you know, like, boastful or anything like that, but like, I'm fairly strong, and I was swinging for the fences on this guy. Like, any normal person, like, would have gone down. And I take a couple swings, and he takes them like nothing. Like, I was, you know, swatting at a fly. And so I back up a couple steps, and then I look down when I have a bigger view of him. And I look down at his hand that he had just swung at my head, and there was a knife in it covered in blood. And I remember very distinctly, like, watching drips of blood fall off the knife. And
wow.
At that point, I'm like, okay, well, this is a very different situation than I thought it was. I don't know if I'm injured at this point. My adrenaline's jacked through the roof, tunnel vision, hearing issues, you know, the typical neurological focusing on the direct threat. And so I back up and I pull my gun out and I start yelling at him to drop the knife. And at this point, I'm like, I get on the radio and I'm like, hey, you know, Raleigh, I've got one at gunpoint. He's got it armed with a knife. Send me some help. And then the cavalry starts coming. And so I'm standing there with this guy at gunpoint, holding the knife about 20 feet away or so, just begging him to drop the knife. And he's, he's, you know, just shoot me, just kill me, just do this. And at that, you know, at that moment, you know, I was a crisis intervention officer, while I was a police officer as well. And I was like, okay, there's something going on. There's something more going on here than just a stabbing incident. And so I keep yelling at him, keep begging him. We get a couple other officers there. They start yelling the same things. And there's a big crowd at this point, and the crowd starts yelling at him too. Like, just drop the knife, man. It doesn't have to end this way. Drop the knife. All those kinds of things happening all at once. It was the most chaotic thing I've ever experienced. And after the other couple officers get there, he finally drops the knife. We take him into custody. And it turns out that he had stabbed his girlfriend in the neck, then tried to stab me. Thankfully, all the blood that was covering me, all that wet stuff, was his from his hand sliding down the blade when he had stabbed her. So thankfully, I walked away from that uninjured. His girlfriend was okay. We got her treated. We got him taken to the county jail, or treated first and then taken to the county jail. So I think that's the one you were referencing, right? Or I think you would have stopped me if that wasn't the right one.
No, that's the right one. And then there was a moment where you met him again.
Yes, yes. About 12 months later, I was sitting in that exact same parking lot where the fight had taken place. I think I was also running somebody for warrants at that point. And I thought I saw him walk out of his old apartment. And I'd stayed in touch with the family while he was incarcerated. It had been a couple months since I'd stopped by and checked in. And I thought I saw him. It was like 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And he walks out, gets in a car, drives off. And so I go up there and I knock on the door. Like, I didn't know he was out yet. So I knock on the door and I talk to his fiance then. And she was like, yeah, that was him. He's back. He's doing great. Like, he's got a job. He's working. We got a baby on the way. You know, he's not drinking anymore. He's really turned his life around. And I was like, oh, you know, like, that's amazing to me. Like, that's what's supposed to happen. Like, you're supposed to get better. You're supposed to be a productive citizen after all of the, you know, after bad things happen or bad choices are made. And so I was like, do you think he'd want to talk to me? And she was like, yeah, I think he really would. And so I waited around until he got back to the apartment and we connected, and we had a really great conversation. Like, he filled me in. He was like, you know, what happened that day changed my life. I'm so grateful that, like, it didn't end differently. And so grateful that I was the guy that was there. Which is a weird thing to, like, save somebody's life at gunpoint. It's a very interesting way for that to happen. But yeah, so after that, you know, we took a picture and I posted it on, I had a Facebook page that I was using at that point to interact with the local community. I posted it on that. And within a couple of days, you know, I'm sitting on camera on Fox and Friends, being broadcast to the nation. But, you know, we stayed connected after that for quite a while. You know, he got a job as a mechanic for a while and then as a truck driver. They had their baby. I haven't talked to him in a very long time now, but it was, you know, it was a really, it was like what it was, you know, like the picturesque, if you will, like what's supposed to happen. Like, bad guy does something bad, does something better, changes his life, takes care of everything. and is then a productive citizen, you know, like.
Yeah. Restorative. Like yes. It's restoration at its finest.
Yeah. Yeah. And, that's, you know, like powerful. we stay connected, you know, like we brought the kids Christmas presents, you know, brought them new bikes that were donated mm-hmm. to the department, those kinds of things. And, yeah, it was a really beautiful relationship, there for a few years between us.
Yeah. That's powerful. So you go through experiences like that. I mean, you remember that day, like, and then you just put on the uniform and go back to work the next day, or do you take a leave? Like, how does that, when there's something like that?
So I was really lucky.
I have a feeling it's not going to be enough, whatever it is.
I was really lucky that, this is an interesting piece. Usually when like something bad happens to me, I usually get hurt right around that same time and then I'm forced to deal with it. So that day, my captain was amazing. He's an absolutely amazing human being, Captain Klein. He left Raleigh PD and then was a chief of police out here in Colorado after he retired from there.
Oh, wow.
I would work for that man again in an instant. So Tommy Klein, if you're listening, thank you very much for what you did for me that day and all my time is working with you. But he sent me home immediately. It was like he had my field training officer from a couple of years prior when I was brand new, like, take me home. And then I worked the next night. I got in a foot pursuit that night with a rape suspect, and I fell during that foot pursuit and I slipped a disc on my back. And 3 days later, couldn't walk. And so then I was on light duty for about 6 months rather than on the job. And so I don't know if that was the universe protecting my psyche where I had time to decompress from all of that or what, but,
yes,
but that's kind of the same.
I think it's plausible.
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing that happened when I left law enforcement. So I left law enforcement on a Tuesday to go work for the nonprofit, had the intention, like, 'cause I got out of the military kind of like without a plan on, you know, 2 weeks notice when I'd planned to be a career Marine. And so I was like, this time I'm going to respect the transition. I'm going to do this right. I'm going to take 2 weeks off. I'm going to decompress. I'm going to take care of myself. So I leave on a Tuesday. I get diagnosed with PTSD the following day officially. And then 4 days later, I'm in a downhill mountain bike crash, destroy my leg, which you and I have talked about my recent surgery 4 years later. Destroyed my shoulder. And so between both of those injuries, I was trapped on my recliner for several months and forced to deal with a couple of decades worth of traumatic incidents, while I'm sitting there on the couch.
Wow. How did that go?
It's real interesting.
What was that like for you?
It's real interesting, you know, like, to have to face yourself, to have to process, to have to grieve, to have to mourn, to have anger, to have joy, all of those things all the time without your normal support system. You know, like law enforcement was my support system, good, bad, or indifferent. At least the dark humor could get us through the day. Thankfully, you know, I had already been working for Uncivilized. I had access to amazing human beings to help support me in that and to support me in hard conversations with myself and to guide me through some of those processes as well.
So you're doing the work of facing a lot of stuff that you hadn't faced for a long time. You had support at the time with Traver and the community. What led you from the police officer to the, I need to transition out of this. What brought you to that space?
So I started my own personal journey, in 2017, my own healing work, like facing, I'd never dealt with my divorce when I got home from Afghanistan mm-hmm. and my, all of it came raging back eventually, like all things that you don't deal with, they come back eventually. Right. And that's what led me to Traver. that was in like the 2.5 weeks that Traver was trying to work as a divorce coach before he realized he wanted to be a men's coach. And I was lucky enough that, you know, at that time he had been helping start a podcast for first responder wellness called The Squad Room that my good friend Garrett Tesla runs. And I really resonated with his message. And I told my current wife about him. And, you know, after a couple of months of me being kind of a jerk, when things started to come back up for me, she was like, I think it's time for you to call that guy. That guy you told me about over the summer. And so I did. And we worked together for a while. And that was really the beginning of my transition out of law enforcement. I'd already kind of had some moments where I was like, maybe it's time. Maybe it's time for me to go. And I thought at that time that I needed to change departments. And so that's what I did. I left Raleigh PD and went out to Holly Springs PD just outside of Raleigh. And I loved both agencies. I really did. I had a good time. I learned a lot. I grew a lot as a human being, as a man, as a leader. But once I pulled back the curtain of like, oh, there's a lot here. It eventually, you know, it's like, once you peek behind the curtain of another way of living, it's really hard to go back. And so I started digging really deep into who I was, into my belief systems, into my values, into my personal history, and really trying to figure out who I was. One of my mentors, Dewey Freeman, he's been a psychologist for 50 plus years. He's trained tens of thousands of therapists. He's got an amazing developmental model that's super easy to understand for, you know, anybody. If you see, you know, if you look at his developmental cone, it's like, you know, coming into being, who, you know, is the world okay? Am I okay? What can I do?
He's going to be on the podcast. How much can I do? And then, so FYI for the listeners.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, go ahead.
So this is a preview for everybody when it comes on. And so now you all know a little bit. You got the answers to the test. But from age 12 to 23 in that developmental model, it's all about who am I? And for me, I got involved in JRTC in high school. And who am I became, what are the military values and belief systems? And the government's, you know, not just the military, but by default, the United States government's values and belief systems. Right. And at that impressionable age, I thought that was all there was. And so I latched onto that and that became my identity. You know, like my personal values back in the day were the Marine Corps core values of honor, courage, and commitment. Right. Nothing else mattered. And that's not who I really am. All of those things are still important to me. Honor, courage, commitment are still very important to me. But love and family and adventure and purpose and impact, you know, those things are important to me. That's who I really am. And I'm a relatively gentle human being for being a former Marine, former police officer, former MMA fighter. And I'm at a point where I don't involve myself in violence anymore. Like I don't even play violent video games anymore. The most violent video game I play is Fortnite with my kids. And that's because my son begs me to play it now. Because violence is not who I am. And, you know, one of our ethos tenets here at Uncivilized is be dangerous, but not a danger. And I think that there was a long time in my life where I was very ego driven, where I was dangerous and a danger because I didn't have the emotional capacity to keep some of those things in check. And that's not just a physical danger. And like I was out attacking people, but I was unsafe emotionally. Like I didn't have the capability to create and hold a safe space for myself or for anybody else. And ultimately what happened for me, I was reading a book by Dr. Robert Masters called To Be a Man. And the most impactful book I've ever read in my life. And in there are three subsequent chapters on anger, aggression, and violence. And in the chapter on violence, there's two pages that talk about how we take young men at, you know, the age of 19 and we put
put them in this military system and we program them to commit violence on behalf of the government. Mm-hmm. And how much of our humanity is taken away from us in that process. Right. And I had always known, like, yeah, like the government had to train me to do this, but it wasn't so much of a mental programming. And so I had this epiphany, and this was when I was a school resource officer, and I was reading this book at lunchtime in my office at the school, and had a complete mm-hmm. breakdown. Everything that all of the unexpressed pain, all of the value conflicts that I'd been living with came flooding out like a 500 gallon per minute fire hose right in my face. And I called Traver because we'd been building Uncivilized for a number of years at this point. And I was like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this. I have no idea. Like, I'm just in tears in my office, hoping there's nothing that happens and that a little kid doesn't come knock on the door to hang out with Officer Boyd. And Traver and I worked through it for a long while that day. And, you know, what it really came down to is that because of all of the work that I had done with him and with Dewey and with Michael Gay and a number of other therapists and other organizations on myself to figure out who I was and to heal from all the things that have happened to me in my life, it came down to the fact that I was just no longer willing or able to commit violence on behalf of the government or on behalf of anyone other than myself and my family. And that was the moment that I knew I had to leave. I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't wear a badge and a gun, and I couldn't put handcuffs on anybody. I couldn't point a gun at anybody. I've been in numerous near shooting incidents. Yeah. And each and every one of those took a toll on not just my psyche, but my soul. Right. You know, I'd done a lot of work on myself to get myself to a place where I was ready to go there. And that's when the real work began. And it's still a work in process. You know, recovering from PTSD is a lifelong journey. But I've had great resources and great support along the way over the last 4 years to get where I am today, to be able to help other men and to help other first responders and veterans now through some of our programs at Uncivilized. Yeah.
And I had listened to a podcast where you were talking about this, and it brought me, and I texted you this shortly after I listened and said this aha moment, because it seems like, okay, you're deciding to leave, but there's this huge premise of having a job like what you were in is done with a message mm-hmm. of pervasive self-sacrifice for the good of others. Like, that's what's instilled. This work is needed. It's in short demand. You're taught, molded, and shaped to be willing to endure more than the civilian so that you can protect, serve, and rescue. So I imagine it's a pretty big deal to say no to that. Like, this huge sense of who you have been and what you've done has been an honorable thing, and to be willing to say, to move from service to other at the expense of self to move into service to self to show up well for others. Like, how was that transition for you?
It was really hard. The day that I turned in my badge, I sobbed like a little baby in my captain's mm-hmm. office. It was like giving up a piece of me. And it's still a work in progress, if I'm being honest. Like, there's we're on the grief podcast. Like, there's the grief informed podcast. Like, there are continuous steps to grief. Yeah. And you learn a little bit more about what you need to grieve at really random moments, just like anything else, you know, just like losing a loved one, you know, it's like, oh, I'm doing okay. And then all of a sudden a birthday or an anniversary comes up and you're like, I'm not okay. Yeah. All of a sudden again, you know, I'm now 4 years out of uniform, and I was at a police conference a couple of months ago and having a blast. Like, I did a lot with the law enforcement torch run for Special Olympics while I was in, and I went back to a conference for that to help out, and I found myself in the middle of the night, like Googling, how do I become a reserve police officer in Colorado? Because I longed for that identity again. I longed for that sense of purpose that I had, that, you know, it felt intrinsic to who I am. But I also then, over the next few days, after like the adrenaline dump wore it off again, you know, like that's what it was. It was the adrenaline. It was the cortisol. It was all the things that make you feel good after a traumatic incident, surviving a traumatic incident. I was like, oh no, like this is what it felt like every day after coming off a shift. And I had to then once again, go back to grief of like, I can't do this again. This isn't healthy for me. It's not healthy for my family. It's not safe for me to be in that world in that way. And so, yeah, there's just this continuous grieving process that continues to take place even to this day.
Being able to, you said that there was the police shooting of the officers. Where was that recently? I'm sorry, Mom.
In Charlotte,
and that activated you as well. And the pain of being able in those moments of like, you're talking to people that you trained with or that you trained, and they're in the field that you miss and love, and how that's very activating as well. That sense of
absolutely
connection to it. So, by the way, I have to say that I do love that you were willing to do the wrestling through that and be able to choose what you needed. And I'm sure deeply impacted your marriage and your relationship with your kids, but was not an easy thing to do, even though you felt necessary, that it was necessary to do it, and brings up that grief work, like you said, constantly. I'm curious for those that are listening that might find themselves in that space and know that they're not quite ready to leave, but boy, oh boy, would they love to know what you might suggest for them to begin to shift their awareness to bridging that gap between the job of compartmentalization to being able to show up for themselves in a way that actually makes a difference in their day-to-day. What would you say to those individuals?
So you've got to be, I want to back up for just a second. Like, the job itself is honorable, like you mentioned before, but being able to take care of yourself and your family for as long as you possibly can is just as honorable as serving others. Like, your family needs you just as much as the public does. And we as first responders, as veterans, as active duty service members, we have to remember that piece. Like, taking care of yourself is just as honorable as taking care of everybody else. And if that means leaving, like finding the courage to do it, is just as important as finding the courage to strap on your vest and your gun every day. And so for anybody who might be on the fence or exploring it, you have to acknowledge that those things exist in your life first. Like, it really starts with acknowledgement that, you know, I've got all of these. The way it was explained to me a number of years ago by Traver was like, it's like you've got all these boxes full of things that you've packed up and tucked away deep in your mind. And then you turn off the lights in the room where you stored all the boxes, but you still have to live in that room. And so you just wander around in that room in the dark, tripping over all of the boxes of all the stuff that you've stuffed away. Yeah. To never be seen or heard from again. And then you're like, you get yourself up, you dust yourself off, and you're like, what the hell was that? And then you ignore it and you move on. And so first and foremost, you need to acknowledge that those things exist within you still. Like, your body keeps the score, as Bessel van der Kolk says, right? Like, that stuff doesn't go away. It's stored in your nervous system, in your subconscious. It's there, whether you admit it or not. And so accepting that that's there and that you have work to do is number one. After that, it's admitting to yourself that it's time to do the work and finding a good place to do that, whether that's in a peer support network, whether that's in a post-traumatic growth retreat, whether that's one-on-one therapy or counseling, or it's working with a coach. a trauma-informed coach. I'm going to make that very clear. Right. A trauma-informed coach. There's a lot of coaches out there that shouldn't be working with people around their trauma and their issues in order to make plans to move forward in life. You know, and then it's being brave enough to dive in, because it's terrifying. Mm. It is absolutely terrifying to go through it. I'm not going to sugarcoat it for anybody out there. Like, it's scary work. It's deep work. It's going to be painful. But the only way to the life that you want to live on the other side is to go through the pain.
Yeah. And that's for either side, if you're deciding to stay in the field or if you decide that you want to work your way out of it. If they're staying in the field, what are you recommending? Like, if you were the guy that took off his tie, you're now him. You're the guy that came in, took off his tie and said, I'm going to do a meditation with you guys.
I know. God. Well, life comes full circle. It really does.
Yeah. And they're the ones not listening to you now. But what is your message?
Yes,
you walk into a room full of people that you used to work with. What are you wanting them to know?
You don't have to die 5 years after retirement.
Is that the statistic?
That's the statistic. Wow. The average police officer dies within 5 years of retirement.
Wow.
Because we don't do this work, because we don't take care of ourselves, because we don't stand up for ourselves, because we don't have healthy boundaries with work, all of those things. I was in a law enforcement only Facebook page the other day. And guys were talking about like off duty pay and off duty compensation and that kind of stuff. And one of the guys was like, yeah, our department policy says you can't ever drink. Even when you're off duty, no matter what, you're always on call. And so like that does things to your nervous system. That does things to your body. Like that constant and prolonged repetitive stress of always waiting for the other shoe to drop or the phone to ring for you to get called in for the next thing. Like people need to stand up for their own well-being and sometimes say no. I know it's really hard. Yeah. It's really hard, especially when you work for the government, to do that.
And then there's also,
but we have to learn how to
set, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to finish and say, we have to learn how to set healthy boundaries in order to take care of ourselves. Because if you can't take care of yourself, you can't take care of anybody else. It's just like if you're on the job and you get hurt, like you have to take care of yourself first. You've got to put the tourniquet on you before you put the tourniquet on your buddy who can't do it for himself.
And then there's stigma, I'm imagining, in these fields for asking for support, especially mental health. And while there's been progress made, do you feel like that's still very much like ingrained in this, I can't, or promotions threatened and things like that?
Absolutely. I will say there are a lot of agencies out there in the country that are doing really, really good work. Raleigh PD, I can speak to specifically, like LAPD. I've worked with their guys a little bit, worked with their employee assistance program and worked with their union, NYPD, Chicago, like some of these larger agencies that have the time and the resources and the manpower to be able to help get people. Yeah. But if we want healthy first responders, it starts with the government being willing to change the way we operate. And that's in training, that's in care, all of those things. And it starts with upper leadership at the government level, not at the police department. It starts with the mayor and city council and the citizens saying, this is what we want for our first responders. Yeah. So that they can take care of us. We've got to take care of them when we ask them to shoulder the burden of what that job entails. Yeah.
So now I want to ask if there's somebody listening who's like, okay, I'm really considering that I would move out of this very duty driven, others focused world of high intense stress, and they want to move away from that. What are some of the things that you would say, hey, you're going to need to know this. This is what you're going to face in order to do that. What are some of the things they're going to have to face?
There's going to be resistance along the way. Like external resistance from peers. There's going to be resistance from your spouse potentially, because you're going to need time to do this, or your partner or your kids or whatever. You're going to have internal resistance of like, this is scary. This is painful. I don't know what's on the other side of this. I don't know who I am without the job. I don't know who I am without the trauma and all those kinds of things. It's going to come up no matter how hard or how much you prepare yourself or how hard you work, you're going to run into resistance. The next thing I would tell people is don't do it alone.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many great resources out there that are, you know, Uncivilized is one of them. If you need an ear, I'm here to listen. Right. Yeah. Like, we've got first responders from all around the world that are a part of our organization, that are also willing to listen. Find a local peer support network, find a culturally competent therapist, because they're out there. There are lots and lots of therapists out there that are trained specifically to work with veterans and first responders. That doesn't mean that, like, being a therapist doesn't mean that you know everything that there is to know about being a cop or being a firefighter or an EMT or a dispatcher. Find the ones that are out there that know what the hell they're talking about and can understand your experience without judgment. Because what we do is unlike anything else in the world. There is nothing that relates to it. And don't suffer in silence. That's going to be my last one. Use your voice. Don't suffer in silence.
Yeah. Wow. That's powerful. And if they do want to work with you, where, what are y'all doing? What are y'all doing there over there with Traver and the Uncivilized?
Yeah. So we have a veterans and first responders only retreat that is led by myself and two other first responders. It takes place over Veterans Day weekend. We offer one-on-one coaching. We have the Uncivilized Nation, like I mentioned, that has men that are in the job or have been in the job that are from all over the world that are willing to listen. I was just talking with a firefighter in Australia a couple of days ago, who's a part of the group. So there's opportunities. You know, I'm more than open to work with men one-on-one. I've got to call a guy in Tennessee, who's a former police officer here in just a little while. So you can find us on, you know, at manuncivilized.com. I'm on Instagram at @uncivilized_Dave, or shoot me an email at dave@manuncivilized.com. I'm always willing to lend an ear for a moment or two.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's incredibly good work and so necessary. And again, honorable, and I'm sure intense at times as well.
Can be. It can be.
Yeah. And before we jump off, I do want to know, like, to go into a little more detail, when someone joins the nation, the Uncivilized Nation, what are they getting access to?
Yeah, definitely. That's a great question. So we have monthly calls all the time. They're like almost every day of the week, there's somewhere or somebody that you can jump on a call with. We have teaching calls. We have support groups. We have calls that are specifically focused on relationship and how you can improve your relationships, whether it's to yourself or to others, your, you know, partners, work, you name it. There's the opportunity to start a men's group in your local area so that you can find support and help support other men.
Guest speakers too.
Books, guest speakers, our whole library of calls from the last 6 years, from pretty amazing human beings on everything from fitness to fashion for men to finances and sexuality and kink and you name it. We've had all sorts of people come in and talk to our men. Yeah. And so every month we're there, like I said, there's always something happening in the Uncivilized Nation. Yeah.
That's so good. I love it. Well, I appreciate you being here and handling the technical difficulties that we had. Editing will be amazing.
Yeah.
But
it's going to be great.
Thank you so much for being here and for the work that you do. And I'm just really grateful to have you here with us. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm happy to come back anytime. Just let me know what you
Absolutely.
Want to jam on.
Absolutely, we'll do it. Because believe me, I will take you up on that. All right.
That's fine. I'm
yes,
for it.
Good. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you the next time.